All right. Back here, you're tuned into 104.1 Berkeley Liberation Radio, or streaming live on berkeleyliberationradio.net. This is DJ Jeronimo.
And I'm DJ Plebe.
We're here. We got a round table. We got about a handful of folks in here. I'm going to let them introduce themselves. If you guys just want to grab the mic right there. Rochambeau, it don't matter.
Okay. I'm Omar. I'm with Occupy Oakland. I was with the media committee briefly. I was in the J28 Action Committee. I was also in the May Day assemblies. And I've been down since day one. It's been a great experience.
Hi, I'm Lauren. I've organized with different committees. I've also been a part of Occupy Oakland as an organizer since the beginning.
Hi, my name's Tony. I've actually been doing most recently work with the Anti-Repression Committee of Occupy Oakland. However, I've been doing a lot of work with the Stop the Injunction Coalition in Fruitvale and North Oakland. So I was a little MIA in the beginning of Occupy Oakland in terms of my committee work, but I was there.
Hi, my name is Steven, and I organize with the Occupy Oakland May Day Assembly.
All right, thanks, guys. So we're dealing with a little bit of technical limitations here in the studio. We only have two microphones, and we're sharing them between six people. So
I think that's infrastructural problems.
Yeah, bear with us here. So anyway, we wanted to start off the conversation, maybe sort of just do a little go around with you guys, and just ask you about, you know, what were your experiences on May Day? What did you see? What happened? To sort of get, you know, try to get some of the, you know, the facts out on the table, just kind of give people a little bit of an update about the other parts of the day that Ida and I didn't get to. And then we're going to come back and talk a little bit more analytically about what, you know, how to understand that and what that means. So maybe starting with you, Stephen.
Sure. On May Day, I sort of floated around the strike stations in the morning, so I just went around different ones and saw what was going on. I took less of an active role in May Day.
Sorry, what were the strike stations? Can you just explain what that
is? Sure. So there were three strike stations set up. There was an anti-gentrification strike station that was set up on 22nd and Telegraph. There was a anti-capitalist strike station, which was set up at Snow Park. And there was a third anti-patriarchy strike station, which was set up at Jack London Square. And the three strike stations sort of coalesced around different themes, and then also had different actions attached to them. So the anti-patriarchy strike station had an action at CPS and Child Protective Services. And then the other strike stations had flying pickets and marches and things like that.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I actually started out at the anti-patriarchy strike station and participated in the CPS action.
Can you maybe explain a little bit about like what that action, like why was there an action at Child Protective Services?
Well, the issue was basically, you know, someone, and I'm probably not the best person to talk about that, okay, because I didn't bottom line it. That's where I started out for the day, and I kind of floated around. So if Lauren wants to talk about that, she can jump in there. I started out there, and then I basically floated around. And my experience, I had a really positive experience on May Day because, you know, I wasn't sure how things were going to go. And then as the marches started going around the city and they started to collect strength and develop like a body, by the time they got all coalesced to 14th and Broadway, it was just a huge agglomeration of people. It was much bigger than I thought it was going to be at the beginning of the morning. And it was really great to reoccupy that space like we used to do in October and November. And that was really great to see. And it did feel like, even though maybe we didn't have the numbers, it did feel like a general strike. And we did shut down that part of downtown. And I was really happy about that. Things changed throughout the day. It was a very fluid day. And we can talk about that in a minute. And I'll hand over the mic.
So I was one of the people who put together the anti-patriarchy strike station. And basically, the anti-patriarchy strike station was a few blocks from the CPS action and was like a refueling point for people participating in that action. So there was coffee and pastries and lots of literature, water, sunscreen, places for people to kind of just hang out and relax and feel safe from the heat of the cops, which, you know, the cops were over by the CPS action, of course. And then just to like touch on what the CPS action was, it was sort of like a rally and confrontation of the Child Protective Services offices. It was inspired by the repression that a lot of parents, in particular mothers, have been facing with Occupy Oakland. One woman temporarily lost custody of her children because her ex-husband filed a restraining order on her against her children under the pretense that she took her children to Occupy Oakland community events. Another woman is under CPS surveillance and has been since she gave birth under surveillance in the hospital due to her participation in Occupy Oakland. I myself, as a parent, have been targeted by the police. I was threatened with arrest for child endangerment when the police charged both me, my daughter, a few friends with their children. And so those events definitely inspired the action, but I think that CPS has been a force against mothers and children for quite some time. The historical implications of white people telling mothers of color how to parent their children, of colonization of families, taking children of color away from their families and giving them to, you know, so-called proper foster families, the persecution of impoverished families for neglect. Certainly many, many queer kids and transgender kids are taken out of their homes or kicked out or abused because of their sexuality or gender. And then they're not allowed to be put into foster families with, queer parents or transgender foster parents. So they're put in group homes and they're monitored by the system until they're 18. And so it was a confrontation of all of these problems. Basically, Child Protective Services acts as a cop to families. So that's what that action was about. And then I kind of floated around after the strike stations, running errands. I have a truck, and so I tend to get roped into these sorts of like errand running deals. And then I rode my bike to meet the Dignity and Resistance March, and like worked on getting Occupy Oakland to join that march in a way that was workable. And then I marched back with Dignity and Resistance. And as soon as I heard those stun grenades in the street around 8:30 or 9, I actually went home because I was just too tired for another street fight. So I'll pass it to Tony.
Thanks, Lauren. So in the morning I happened to be with the anti-gentrification strike station just to check it out. But more importantly, I think as part of my day, the anti-repression committee actually organized an action, probably took place more around 1 o'clock, because actually of police interference with the strike. But we led a little bit of street theater to put the state on blast, to show folks that we're actually trying to organize against the state repression, against our comrades who've been arrested and been issued stay-away orders. And so we theatrically, but also, you know, it is our desire to give the state and all of its representatives stay-away orders from our own movement. So we issued stay-away orders to various city council members, mayors, and district attorneys, and also brought some of the folks with stay-away orders to the plaza because technically they're not allowed to be there as activists. So we wore masks of those activists to kind of bring their energy to the plaza. So that was a really exciting moment, and we really hope that we can do that again, because oftentimes, certainly on a day with so much going on, there's so many different actions going on, and I think we really want to do that again, because it was just a quick action, and I think really putting some emphasis on that as a movement would be really good for Occupy Oakland to move forward.
Tony, you mentioned police interference with the strike or the march early on during the day. I wonder if you guys can talk, just, you know, getting some more of this information out on the table. A lot of, you know, this has been covered in the newspapers and stuff, but just to sort of talk about your own experiences, what you saw with the police, what kinds of strategies or tactics the police were using to mess with the marches, and, you know, what kind of violence, what kind of state repression did people face on May 1st?
Well, I was just handing the mic, so I'm Omar, not Tony, but I thought it was, I hate to say interesting, but I mean, it's of interest. I think it should be of interest to activists what police did on that day. So after the convergence of 14th and Broadway, there were a lot of people there, maybe about 1,000 people in the middle of the street. And some people heard that the banks that had been shut down on one of the first go-arounds had reopened, so it didn't take. And so an autonomous group went out to shut them down again. They were going to shut them down in the same way that, like, groups like Causa Justa and ACE shut down banks, by just using civil disobedience, standing in front of the door. And usually banks close the doors rather than have to deal with that stuff. And that's just how it happened. So after a kind of successful march around that bank area around Grand, the march headed back up Broadway, literally like a half a block before getting back to the plaza. And I think it's important to note that one of the leaders of the march, who had a megaphone, said, "We can't shut down any more banks." We were in front of Chase, and he said, I'm pretty much quoting here, is, "We can't shut down Chase. We don't have time. We have a schedule to keep at Oscar Grant Plaza. There's a noontime rally, and we need to be there." So he began, and others began to lead the march back. It's very clear that it was going back to the plaza. Half a block before it gets to the plaza, riot police start running behind the protesters. I mean, literally chasing them. There's a feeling of panic among protesters. They can't move forward without looking back. They don't know whether someone's going to club them in the back or there's going to be a flashbang. And then they started targeting people. It seemed really random and crazy the way they targeted people. I saw the way they threw down the first person, who's like, I think she's a 21-year-old woman. You know, wrenching her hands behind her back, putting their knee in her back. She's like screaming in terror and pain.
Knocking her off her bike, right?
And they knocked her off her bike. It was just completely uncalled for and, you know, unwarranted. But I think what it basically gave them a chance to do was to sort of antagonize the crowd into maybe doing some things that they may not have done. I mean, they were headed towards the plaza. At that point, it became a showdown between the police and protesters. And I was sort of impressed with the way demonstrators acted, because they held their ground. They wouldn't give in to police, and they pushed the police back, and police eventually left at that moment, and then they came back. But I wanted to make one more point. Sorry, I'm hogging the mic, because I wrote this down and I wanted to make it. Because my understanding of what happened later on that night after the permitted protest by the Dignity and Resistance March was what triggered, supposedly, ostensibly triggered, the police repression of the plaza at around 8:30, was a stay-away order. They spotted someone who was there with a stay-away order. And that's sort of like an echo of the idea of permitted versus non-permitted, and the fact that it's up to the city to permit. I'm going to say, I know not everyone thinks the Constitution is valid, but constitutionally protected rights, or these are considered internationally human rights, the right to assembly and the right to speak in public, right?
And this is to assemble in public space.
And to assemble in public space, not only in public space, but in front of city hall, in front of city government, like, and how crucial and important that is. So they give these arbitrary stay-away orders that are given in a way that there's no trial for. None of these people, it's my understanding, and Tony can jump in, have been convicted or even tried on any charges, right? And so it's just like this extra-legal non-permit onus hovering around these people. And I think it's I don't know exactly where I'm going with this, but there's a nice reflection there. There's a nice echo of the idea of permitted versus permitted, and how arbitrary that is, and how that's just a way to separate good protesters from bad protesters, and to make us feel like some people are legal and some people are illegal, and that has a lot of other permutations for that day as well. And I'll hand over the mic.
Yeah, Ken, maybe some others of you, like Stephen or Lauren or Tony, can talk about you know, a little bit more about what you saw the police doing, like what kinds of weapons were they using? I mean, it sounds like from what Omar was saying and what we saw on the streets that day, that they were kind of, they had maybe changed their tactics a little bit, and they were using sort of snatch squads a little bit more than this massive, overwhelming shock and awe force. don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about the snatch and grab squads. The Oakland Police Department had a press conference a little before May Day to announce this new crowd control strategy. And people might not be aware, but the Oakland Police Department has a court-mandated crowd control policy from 2003 that they're supposed to follow that they already weren't following. And then they just sort of were like, well, we're going to do this new strategy without like checking in with the courts or really anyone else. And they presented this new image of policing that's basically this military strategy of running in, like throwing in stun grenades, scaring the crap out of people, beating people up, snatching people and arresting them for no apparent reason. And when they were questioned on it, they actually had another press statement released saying that they weren't going to start that crowd control policy until May 2nd. Then on May 1st, you know, we all expected that they would still use it and that it would lead to smaller but more intensified police violence, which it did. And they did use it. And when they were questioned by the press, they said, yes, you know, we are using this new strategy. But I think that one of the things that's really interesting to point out is that the Oakland Police Department's crowd control policy, their policing of crowds has been so terrible that they were able to go to the public and present a snatch and grab squad as an improvement in policing, which is like crazy that they did this. And what we saw was that, yes, they did go in and beat the crap out of people. There was a 19-year-old young woman who was pushed down and then took a baton to the head. She had 19 staples in her head. A 13-year-old girl in the nighttime was batoned in the back by the police, which I think is extremely relevant given the criminalization of children, particularly in Oakland, which I'm sure Tony will be happy to tie into gang injunctions. So what we saw was this intensified, like hand-to-hand, it's not really hand-to-hand combat because it was all one-sided, but where they came in and they were physically violent with their hands, you know, attacking people individually or throwing flashbangs into the crowd, which were hitting people in the head, causing severe burns to people's heads, feet, other body parts. So, you know, obviously these snatch and grab squads are extremely dangerous and present this, you know, where anybody in the crowd can accidentally be targeted and have their life in jeopardy. And so it's designed to scare people away from being there.
Does somebody else want to say anything about their what they saw with the police? Yeah, Stephen.
Well, it's not so much about what I saw about the police, but I just wanted to make a few sort of broader or conceptual points about some of the police repression on that day, on May Day. For one thing, part of the narrative was that those snatch and grabs actually facilitated protests in a way that was better than previous incidents. So in terms of mass tear gassing and sort of the violence and arrests that we saw on J-28, and that was something that both the Oakland Police Department and, you know, newspapers like The Cron and others pushed, that that kind of minimal violence or minimal use of force was sort of how it was described, actually facilitated better protest. And so I think that's really interesting to think that kind of very targeted, like individualized violence is actually helping people on a broader scale to protest. And that was actually facilitating their ability to gather peacefully all around while they have individual comrades who are getting violently attacked and snatched up. I think the other important point to make is that if we're taking this call for a general strike seriously, we're assuming that what we were doing on the street that day was striking, the police were striking and were attacking workers. And I think that because they're not necessarily in a recognized union picket line, it's sort of like assumed that they're not workers. But, I mean, that was police attacking a strike, whether it's an official strike or not. And because that's so far out of place of just, you know, dominant discourse, that it doesn't really register that way. But, I mean, that's what I think what they were doing was attacking striking workers, and because they're not unionized, it carries a different weight.
Yeah, I actually was rolling up to the march to downtown around a little after noon, and I just saw the tear gas. I think it was after they had tackled the woman on the bike. And, you know, I was just kind of going, it's barely noon and there's already tear gas. What, you know, what is going on? But, yeah, I think a lot of it had to do with are they calling it an improved crowd control? The snatch? And, yeah, I mean, so we're going to take a musical break. You're listening to the Latos Zapatistas here at 104.1 Berkeley Liberation Radio. Or at berkeleyliberationradio.net. We're going to take a musical break and we'll be back. Ahora. Stay tuned.
La Pachamama reclama por bajo a la mancala, mata al panorama, paringos que traman, robo y todo suyo proclaman. Estamos unidos contra Estados Unidos, somos esclavos hundidos, pero entendámonos, instruimos. Este comercio necio a todo le pone precio, es un tropiezo como el trapecio que un tercio de humano vivamos en desprecio. Demos gracias al Estado por esta democracia de mercado, ahora hemos dejado demostrado que hemos estado domesticados contra cadenas y crueles condenas. Somos esa molotov anónima que se estrelló contra la moneda. Atentos, buscan culpables como pretextos y somos todo lo que lanzamos, esa botella que representa el descontento. Daniel Benko o Atenco es el vuelco violento de un sistema terco y puerco. El descontento crece, la organización se fortalece, pese a que represente mil voces, mil veces aparece. Su vida ofrece, me preocupa, te ocupa, desocupa, abajo escupa. Con Luca esta puta educa y lucra mudas como puca. El idiosincrasia compra la democracia, hubiera lanzado con arrogancia, se amola la moneda un estando y tiró de gracia. La ley por sospecha se echa, mientras la derecha con el PC mano estrecha, ahora hasta un calcetín pasa por mecha. No hay pausa, parque lucha por una causa, la injusticia social justifica el hip hop, lo demás es solo una farsa.
Oye, 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 oye. Hey. El Estado usa capucha y ficha, el que con dicha en su versión el micro fluye, norma destruye, tienen sus propias máscaras, porque están su cáscara, ocultan su ambición en leyes que llenan al que no sostiene su sátira, porque la máquina existe, existo, el veredicto, atacarla, destruirla, aniquilarla, ellos te quieren como un adicto, o como un chico normal, pero normalidad impuesta, eres sano para el manicomio, si eres soñador la cana te espera, te cae la teja vieja, la resca para el subversivo, deja la actitud de pendejo corrosivo, te dejo un dejo, te duda la dura muralla, son dura la pura por una postura segura, la sumatoria será positiva, si paredes caen, el fruto es maduro, que somos duros no, estamos seguros, ok, ser subversivo, mantenerse vivo donde orden, patria y repren ley, si eres un chico tranqui de la onda india está bien, si no eres rico eres punk indígena, te tiraste, te quieren joder.
En resistencia, autodefensa, no es violencia, sin inteligencia, contra una extensa ofensa, piensa.
La violencia viola inocencia y ya vio que la ciencia está al servicio de la prepotencia.
En resistencia, autodefensa, no es violencia, sin inteligencia, contra una extensa ofensa, piensa.
La violencia viola inocencia y ya vio que la ciencia está al servicio de la prepotencia.
CNN y PPN en la tele te desinforma, N, quieren en tus sienes su norma y lo que les conviene a quienes tienen el poder y son el enemigo, tienes de al TLC, somos CNN, subversivos. Que la cola, víboras vivas, devoran vidas que elaboran rima, mejor aquí más, peor a mira y la ley no apoyan. El pobre se organiza, concientiza y pisa al hombre que privatiza, sobrevive y analiza que en cada publicidad está presente la cara sonriente de un tarado de la clase dominante. En este charco blanco y narcotraficante son gantes con guantes blancos que expanden droga por todas partes. Violenta su salud y educación de mercado, violenta es la subcontratación y los salarios, violento el Estado y su perversa fuerza. Nuestra respuesta no es violenta, puesto que es autodefensa. Autogestión y autonomía se visible, que la jerarquía de un Estado es inservible. Somos libertarios, no liberales, capitalinos contra el capitalismo y sus capitanes. Derecha y concertación son patanes de plástico, patarratas que empatan en corrupción. Libertad a los reos del neoliberalista. Y ahora tú, dime, ¿quién es el terrorista?
Piensa que ahora podrá reinar sin que nadie lo desafíe.
Nah, es ahora cuando. Basta de ponerle otra mejilla, ¿saben?
All right. Back here with Relato Zapatista. That was Salvaje Decibel, Autodefensa. Actually, all their stuff is downloadable for free on the internet. So, again, that's Salvaje Decibel out of Chile. We're coming back here. We're going to continue our conversation about May 1st. We wanted to jump into kind of talking a little bit around the framing of this year's May 1st. There was, as we mentioned in the introduction, Occupy LA had called for a general strike, and it kind of caught on. A lot of Occupies really kind of aligned themselves in terms of framing this year's May 1st around that idea. And so we kind of wanted to just kind of throw that out there. What is the importance of the general strike today? Obviously, it has a lot of historical connotations. What does the general strike look like today? Given that, you know, one of the big actions that was planned for this year was the shutting down of the Golden Gate Bridge. And it seemed, you know, there was a lot of ambiguity around why the event was canceled, but given that Adrenaline Strike was called, it sounded like the Labor Council of the Golden Gate Bridge Labor Council kind of stepped back, and you know, you would think that General Strike, unions have played a big role in it. They back out at the last minute.
Sure. So I was one of the Occupy Oakland organizers who was working with the Golden Gate Labor Coalition on the bridge shutdown. And so I just want to kind of quickly go through what the history was of that action coming into Occupy Oakland and then talk about why we pulled out. And so we were approached by some organizers in Occupy Oakland who've worked on some other major actions like the port shutdowns. Were approached by some rank and file members of the Inland Boatmen's Union, which is one of the unions in the Golden Gate Bridge Coalition. And we were requested to come to this coalition meeting to talk about the potential for a Golden Gate Bridge shutdown. And so some of us attended these meetings with the Golden Gate Labor Coalition, and it seemed like at first that they were really looking for this, like joint action that they were going to have with Occupy. They were kind of presenting it to us this way, like, you guys bring the tactical wherewithal and a bunch of people who are supportive, and like, we'll, you know, we have these union folks who are ready to strike and they're angry and they're being screwed over and all they want is to not have to take a whole bunch of money off their check for healthcare. And what it ended up being was that we were going to these meetings and the union organizers have gotten so bad at negotiating that it's like this, you know, theater act for them to do this, this thing every time a contract comes up, and they don't have the skills to actually organize the workers, and they don't have the skills to actually negotiate a good contract. And so what they were counting on was that rather than having to hire picketers at minimum wage to come in to picket for, you know, Golden Gate Bridge workers who make well over minimum wage, that they could have us come in for free and organize this big spectacle. You know, we pointed out to them on more than one occasion they were asking us to take time off of work from our jobs that we weren't being paid for to do what they get paid good money to do for free. It was, what we found was that they had wanted us to sort of come in as this mob that would back them up as a bargaining chip. And they were really surprised and scared and angry when we responded to them by saying, we need to understand what's going on. We need to talk to the rank and file. We need to be able to present this in a way where we can get large buy-in. This struggle can't just be us showing up for you. This has to, we can't just say, we're going to make this contract better for these workers. You know, you want to make that contract better. Great. We want to have a success for the class. And that's what we're here to do. And so we were met with a lot of resistance, and we decided as this group of organizers, even though we had already presented it to the body of Occupy Oakland, and it's, you know, it's such a romantic action to shut down this international icon, right? And it was like, of course everybody wanted to do it, but you know, we went back to the group and we said, how about we make these conditions and bring them back to the coalition? Well, before people had even voted unanimously to approve those conditions, like that this coalition would work with us, that they wouldn't denounce us or, you know, distance themselves from us in the press, they were already going against these conditions, which we knew we had to get out, and we knew that they would, but these conditions were really reasonable. So they were passed unanimously and we were able to pull out with the coalition.
What were the conditions, just for curiosity's sake?
Sure. Well, the conditions for the coalition were that we would have at least one of the bridge unions go on strike, and we'd be able to announce to the press that there would be a strike. Another was that there would be a picket line, a real picket line, a hard picket line with union members at or on the bridge that we could go reinforce. Another one was that they wouldn't distance themselves from us in the press, that they and the other organizing bodies would commit to outreach. I'm trying to think, were there any more?
About the tactical.
Oh, exactly. That we would have input for tactical, that the Labor Solidarity Committee tactical team would be able to participate in tactical, so that we didn't, you know, put our people in this terrible position to be, you know, sitting down and getting arrested in front of the police. And so we were able to pull out with a coalition. The problem is that the unions organize in this way where all of the workers vote to strike and all of the workers want to do these things, and they have these sham, like democratic votes in these elections where people do democratically vote to do things, but it all comes down to one person, the business manager or the president of the union, to make the decision about what to do. And so even though these unions had voted to strike, gotten their strike sanctions, and it was more than one, it was plenty of them, the people who were leading those unions chose not to strike. And so they were able to make these really quick decisions. We're not going to have a shutdown, or we're not going to have a rally, or we're going to have this union go on strike or that union go on strike, whereas Occupy Oakland organizes democratically. And so we would have to wait almost a full week to be able to go through our entire democratic process where people could consent upon what Occupy Oakland would do. And so, of course, they were always one step ahead of us in the press and creating all of these questions for us to deal with. But ultimately, it was the right decision for us to get out. And what we found was that people still do want to shut down the bridge. They just don't want to shut down the bridge for the same reasons. They want to shut the bridge down as an anti-capitalist action and not as an action to support these unions who are, you know, basically going through these theatrics to protect their jobs as business reps for their union.
I wanted to add in that context, and I agree with everything Lauren just said, but also, I mean, one of the biggest victories about May Day was the fact that labor, for the first time in a very, very, very long time, chose that day as their Labor Day, you know, and you have Obama calling it, what was it, Loyalty Day? Loyalty Day on that day, and I mean, I think that's, I don't know who came up with that. Which president came up with that title? It was just a way of like...
It was a Cold War.
Yeah, it was a way of subverting the idea because they thought it was a communist idea. So you have ILWU chose that day to have their... It wasn't exactly a strike, but they did do it symbolically. They shut down the port of Oakland. You have CNA having a strike on that day. You have workers, janitors, Local 87 in San Francisco coming out on that day. And you have the IBU, picketing ferries and shutting down the ferries on that day. And Lauren wants to do it. But I do want to make another point, and I'm going to go soon, so I get to hog the microphone for another second.
I just wanted to add in that the IBU, the Inland Boatmen's Union, is the ferry workers. And so one of the things that we found organizing with this labor coalition is that with the Golden Gate Bridge, the bridge itself has a profit, makes a profit on the tolls that come across, and the ferries have a deficit. And so for the Golden Gate Transportation District, the ferries are subsidized by the bridge. And so when we talked about shutting down the bridge, this was the only way to hit the bottom line of the transportation district. You know, the boss in this contract with these 19 unions. And so when they decided not to have the shutdown but to strike at the ferries, they were actually saving the Golden Gate Transportation District money, and they were able to make the strike a complete joke by saying, fine, you want to picket the ferries in the morning until 10 a.m., we're going to shut down the ferries until 2 p.m., you're saving us money, and you're the ones that are inconveniencing all of the commuters, right? And so you get all the bad press, we get all the good press, and we save a bunch of money. And so this is another area where these union organizers just either they don't know what they're doing, they don't care what they're doing. Either way, they're completely ineffective for the workers. So I just want to jump in with that, talking about the IBU strike, which was just almost a joke.
Okay, and I just want to say a couple more things, and then I'm going, and you guys can have the microphone back. So what I was going to say before Lauren took the mic, but which was great that she did, and I'm glad she did, but you know, there's been a lot of talk about what did Occupy Oakland or the Occupy movement in general accomplish on that day, on May Day. And I think you can lay the entire, every union that walked out on that day, what I think was inspired by the Occupy call to observe May Day and have a big general strike on that day. So that was like a huge victory for labor that's been somnambulant for a really long time. And it was a huge victory for Occupy. And Occupy Oakland, especially in Northern California and the Bay Area. But I also wanted to, before I go, I wanted to talk about a couple things. You know, one thing that got covered in the press was how Occupy Oakland ended up at San Antonio Park. And I just wanted to clarify how that happened and why, because there's been sort of a rumoring going around about that. Basically, you know, the people who were in the plaza that day waiting for the march to begin and to come to Oscar Grant Plaza got chased out of the plaza by police. And not knowing what else to do and not wanting to give up the public sphere on that day, they decided to go in a feeling of solidarity and camaraderie, go meet the march at the park right? And so I joined people at the park, and I can tell you that the mood there was festive. People were announcing Occupy victories and Union victories throughout the nation, and people were very excited about joining the march. When there was word about the march coming, people literally just jumped off the grass and were hooting and hollering and just cheering, and it was a dumb move. I mean, this has to be said. You don't take 400 people straight into the street in front of a march that's coming, but it wasn't a purposeful move. I think people just all got excited and wanted to get out on the street. Once they got into the street, I don't think they understood that they were maybe impeding the way that the march got there. But I think there was a lot of solidarity there, and people really wanted to be a part of everything that was going on that day. There's been some talks, and people have been saying, oh, you know, they went there to, you know, foil the march or to co-opt the march or whatever it was. And that's really, really, really not true. I was there, and I can assure you that it was just a feeling of a large amount of solidarity. And it was great hanging out with you guys. I've got to go. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Omar.
And while we're sort of on that, I kind of wanted to, I mean, it's interesting, like Lauren and Omar were just talking a lot about strikes that workers rank and file had actually voted for to go on strike, and that a number of unions did actually choose to make May 1st their official sort of Labor Day or whatever, go on strike officially on that day. And I just wanted to ask you, kind of getting back to the original question that we posed, maybe Stephen, you could talk a little bit about sort of why do we want a strike? Like, what's the objective? Why is the strike the tactic that Occupy Oakland is adopting right now, in the context of you know, everything that's going on, the history of occupying the plaza, and you know, on May Day in particular?
Sure. So I think one thing, the reason that a strike has a broader value for folks who are not just in labor unions is that many of them don't identify from the position of, say, a worker that we normally think of a worker. And so that does carry like the idea of the precarious worker and other things like that. But it also just includes the idea that many folks don't really have a relation to work in the same way anymore. Some of them don't work at all, or work in ways that are considered, you know, like wageless, that don't actually bring in, you know, a stable amount of money. But also a lot of them have a relation to work that's different in terms of consumption. So like in terms of debt or things like that. And so I think like a general strike, a broader strike in terms of actually shutting down or attacking capital, has a greater value for people who don't necessarily have a contract fight that they're trying to win and have no interest in a contract fight. And also for certain folks who may be in unions who feel that those unions are not serving their interests in a broader way beyond just a contract fight, that they actually have sort of a larger social function. And so I think that a part of the spirit of a general strike is also sort of a strike against the authority develops in a union, so against a union boss or a union manager, or things like that.
I know we've thrown around the word precarity and precarious workers. I'm just wondering if you could kind of maybe give a little bit of a definition of what that means and why that's a big deal if precarious workers strike.
Sure. So I think there's actually been a lot of problematic talk about the way that the precarious worker has been constructed in the Occupy debate. There's been also debate about can a precarious general strike happen? Is that something that can happen? I believe that it was Natasha Leonard wrote a piece about it for Salon, saying, you know, is this something that can happen? Like, can this labor force bring this about? And I think for one thing that's really problematic about that is the fact that so-called precarious workers already organized a mass general strike, and that's what a lot of people identify as being May 2006. And those were, in every sense, a precarious worker strike, and it was a mass, you know, job action.
That's exactly. I mean, that's sort of the way that we were trying to frame it. The immigrant, the migrante, the undocumented worker, as the sort of paradigmatic figure of the precarious worker in today's economy.
So there's this weird sort of ahistorical erasure of all of that activism that I think has been sort of problematic from like an ultra-left standpoint, that sort of said that sort of ignored that entire movement and said that, well, now this is basically something that's run by these liberal nonprofits, and you know, that's what we saw in the Dignity and Resistance March, was this sort of boring, you know, washed out march. And I think that the reality is that march brought that kind of actual strike that we're talking about today, and that actually happened. And so I agree with that critique of, you know, oh, sure, that march was boring, or it's not as strong as it could be. I think it's also important to acknowledge where this idea of a strike outside of a labor union came from, and that was actually something that was visible and on the table and happened.
All right, cool. So we're going to take a musical break one more time, and we'll be right back. This is Relato Zapatista here at 104.1 Berkeley Liberation Radio, and you can find us on the web at berkeleyliberationradio.net. Stay tuned, and we'll be back in a sec. I'm DJ Jeronimo with DJ Plebe here. Again, we're at 104.1 Berkeley Liberation Radio. Actually, we haven't given out the phone number in a minute. So I'm going to throw that out. It's 510-495-1666. Again, that's 510-495-1666. If you got a comment, you were at the march, any of the marches that, or any of the actions that we're talking about, you just got an opinion about anything that we've talked about so far, please feel free to call it and join the conversation. I'm going to hand it over to DJ Plebe. He's going to dive into a broader, I guess the broader implications in terms of really looking at some of the repression that's come down from the city, from the state, and so on, and just kind of how that's really affecting folks on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you. I think we started getting into with that last comment the sort of issue that we began the show with in the introduction, talking about what does a general strike mean in an age where an age of austerity and an age in which the dominant economic condition is that of precarity. And Stephen was talking, and you were talking a little bit about sort of what precarity means. In a lot of ways, you know, you were talking about the precarious worker and the you know, the migrante as the perhaps the most precarious worker out there. And I think that's a really the figure of the migrante is really important, because part of what the his or her experience is, part of what the experience of precarity is, has to do with strictly sort of an economic condition, right? Like getting terrible wages, you know, being paid under the minimum wage, not really having any legal rights or ability to sort of bargain with employers and so on, having not being able to, you know, have any sort of health benefits and so on, that kind of stuff. But there's another side to precarity, which has to do a lot with a sort of experience of the police state, right, and of state violence, especially with the migrante, but with you know, a lot of us, and you know, we talked a little bit about the police response to the march the other day on May 1st. So I think it would be really interesting to think about like what precarity means beyond simply being an economic condition, how it intersects with questions of state violence, institutional violence, racism, and sexism. And also with space and thinking about the notion of public space and what is public space for and who can move through the city in a way that isn't precarious, who can move through the city with security and who can't. So maybe we could go back to you, Tony, and talk, because you were working with the Anti-Repression Committee and talking earlier about your stay away action that you guys did in front of City Hall. Maybe you could talk just a little bit more about the stay away orders in general, and sort of what they might mean, what they are, you know, and who's been given a stay away order, and also then what that might mean for a person who sort of moves through or walks around in the city, how that might affect their own experience of living here in Oakland.
Sure. Well, I think actually, in thinking about the notion of precarity, we also have to consider those who have been targeted by the state, have been convicted felons. Individuals with felonies in the United States also are extremely are precarious workers and are often not allowed and restricted from even working because of their conviction history. And I think in terms of a lot of the folks who have been targeted by the state in Occupy Oakland have been individuals who already have previous convictions, prior convictions, and are currently on probation or on parole. And so a number of those individuals actually were arrested again on May 1st and are violated or given violations for violating their probation, but also for violating these so-called stay-away orders, which have been issued by the state, as was talked about earlier, without any actual conviction in these so-called courts. So I think all those things kind of come together where in Occupy Oakland and in Oakland in general, where young men of color specifically are being given stay away orders, as well as other activists. But I think it's particularly important to think about them and their relationship to organizing, because it is a very traumatic and torturous experience being in the dungeons of the United States. And that is just part and parcel of the experience, not only of migrant workers, but people who have been trying to find meaningful work and in their lives as people of color in the United States who are have been exposed to constant racism throughout their education and then discriminated against in the job sector. So we have, in Oakland especially, extremely high unemployment rates for people of color, men of color especially, but women of color as well. And thus, there's a huge underground economy that people must resort to, which creates these interesting and really fucked up relationships with the police. And that is why I think Oakland police have been at the forefront of repression in the entire country.
Yeah, and it's interesting too to point out that OPD and a lot of police departments around the country have had ties with the with Homeland Security the militarization of police departments. I think there was a tank that came out on Tuesday night. Two tanks that came out on Tuesday night. But in terms of going back around the idea of a stay away order, I mean, it is what it sounds like, right? It's an order to stay away. But we're talking about Oscar Grant Plaza. We're talking about people in their neighborhoods. Can you kind of give us a little bit more detail about like what that actually means for folks who have a stay away order? How do they maneuver? How do they get around the city if they're being told, you know, where they can and cannot go?
Sure. Well, I think some folks have stay away orders, like what's previously said, to Oakland City Hall, which means they can't be there at all at any time, unless it's on official business, I believe, some technicality like that, which the police can abuse whenever they want, I'm sure. And other folks have stay away orders from other locations, like the Kaiser Convention Center, which was one of Occupy Oakland's desired locations to develop a community space to provide services to the people of Oakland that the city is not providing. And then with gang injunctions, it's slightly different because, well, the stay away orders are given to folks who have been who are being tried for criminal charges, whereas folks on gang injunctions are young men who the police believe or want to make an argument that they are involved in gang activity. And oftentimes their definition of a gang, all the time their definition of a gang is based on racist stereotypes of young Latino and black men. And so those individuals cannot interact with each other within their communities. Oftentimes that includes family members. And they also have a curfew that they have to obey. And so
the guys who are who have a stay away order through the gang injunction, they haven't been tried or they haven't been charged with anything. It's the city just says you guys cannot hang out with each other. And if you do, you're going to get locked up.
That's correct. It's more along the lines of what we were talking about with Child Protective Services, where it's more of a civil restraining order. The city has taken on kind of personhood and says that it's being abused by this quote-unquote gang and these individuals. And so it's basically they're saying that the gang is a nuisance and must stay away from these locations so that it can no longer create these nuisances in their own community, where actually a lot of these individuals are trying to better their community, are involved in developing strong community ties and services for their communities. So it's quite interesting to see who the police has targeted for the gang injunctions and the stay away orders, and trying to build real solutions for Oakland, which is what the Stop the Injunction Coalition and Occupy Oakland has been trying to do from the start.
So thinking about, starting from the point of the stay away orders and the gang injunctions, I mean, what it makes me think of is the way that the state, through its arm, the arm of the police, is remaking the map of the city. is reorganizing the space of the city into zones that are safe and zones that are unsafe for certain kinds of people or certain individuals at certain times, and how those sort of that remapping affects the experience of individuals moving through the city. And I think this connects actually back with sort of what you guys were talking about earlier with the snatch squads and the way that snatch squads can target individuals in a crowd in a way that's, you know, completely unexpected, right? So you never know exactly when the snatch squad is going to come after you and knock you off your bike and throw you on the ground and arrest you or beat the shit out of you. And in some ways, like, people who have a stay away order know a little bit about where the stay away order, where that boundary is. But in another sense, I mean, it's a little bit, you know, as far as I know, the stay away orders say, like, you can't be within 300 feet of City Hall or something like that. And it's unclear a little bit where that 300 feet is. And as you were saying, Tony, the cops can just sort of enforce these things at will in a sort of an arbitrary manner. So I don't know, Stephen, maybe you could talk a little bit about sort of what these different policing and law regimes that are enacted across the space of the city do to the experience of individuals or groups of people moving through that space and interacting and engaging with that space, because I think that'll help us get to a little bit further towards understanding precarity beyond just a merely economic condition.
Yeah, sure. So I think that these strategies, the major thing they accomplish, at least in the space of downtown, is to securitize downtown for certain types of activities, like you mentioned. So I think that they make zones that are safe for consumption, for certain types of sanctioned leisure activities. So, like, you know, Art Murmur is a sanctioned leisure activity. Having a dance party at it is not. I mean, you sort of see these constant distinctions about what is okay to do in public space and what isn't. And so something like that is okay. I think that, you know, we saw tanks and all that kind of, you know, absurd force deployed in downtown Oakland. That was a part of showing this sort of, like, downtown is secure, it's safe, we're making it safe for certain interests. There was, you know, a really interesting article that came out recently in the San Francisco Chronicle that talked about sort of, like, the landscape of downtown Oakland after Occupy Oakland had been removed, you know, assuming that Occupy Oakland was gone, which in itself, you know, has a host of problems attached to it. And the sort of the narrative, the storyline was, you know, the tear gas is gone, but the coffee shop is back. And, you know, sort of this thing of, like, you know, now this is an area that's very safe to consume things, to, you know, hang out and drink organic coffee and beer and things like that. But it's a downtown that has to be sanitized of dissent in order for that to be something that's okay. And that, you know, we have to remove any sort of sign of dissent from the city in order for it to be a place that's safe for people to be. And, you know, David Harvey gave this interview recently where he talked about sort of all these policies that are effectively banishing people from the city. And the stay order is definitely one of them that it banishes, but it also welcomes certain people in. And so that's where I think the connection between, like, the anti-gentrification picket really was important, because that was not just, you know, about certain businesses, but also that these businesses are being posited as great things, but dissent isn't. And so, I mean, there's all sorts of crazy things that happen there, but in that one article, they do talk about how certain businesses are getting 6 months of free rent to be in downtown Oakland, but, you know, people who are displaced by foreclosure aren't. And so, you know, so why are those decisions being made, and why is a so-called local business, like, say, Awaken Cafe, which also pays its workers minimum wage and pays its managers not much better, considered, like, a great thing for downtown Oakland, but a homeless person who's been foreclosed upon isn't?
All right, I think we're going to go to a short musical break, and then we'll be back with a sort of wrap-up discussion and kind of a final question.
Who was blessed with a soul. Let me tell you about a place you probably don't know. Yeah. We still live in Cali, got a style, culture, role. We was known for the 60s, for Panthers and hippies. Now we known for murders, pimps, and 360s. Sideshows, high-speed chases, too. And a crack epidemic that'll turn you blue. And an AIDS epidemic that could end you, too. It's the yay, baby, bubba, and I thought you knew. Yeah. Oakland to Vallejo, Vallejo to the Zay. The Zay to the Skull, a.k.a. as the Bay. Unique, so to speak, in a whole lot of ways. We hardly get the love, because we close to LA, we got our own slang, but everybody took it. Now we going dumb down the Ave, driving crooked.
Pacific. Beach always closed, so don't get the gang twisted. Thugs repossessed to the death, packing biscuits. Weed almost legal, the trees is terrific.
We got cannabis clubs.
Filipinos and blacks, Latinos from all over the map. Chinese and Vietnamese, so don't get jacked. Samoans, Indians, Tongans, Thais. It's the Bay, homie, and we multiplies. We never act shy when it's time to ride. And we claim Tupac as a source of pride.
I say and we claim Tupac as a source of pride.
Let it go, let me bless the flow, my people. Here we go, here we go, here we go. From the streets to the beach, flatlands to peace. To the freaks in the jeeps driving by.
Baby.
To the heat, need to see. To the cops on the beat. To the rich, live a sweet. To the poor, feel a weak. To the youth in the beast, HB, Third Street. Telegraph to the Ave North, to the deep east. Telegraph to the Ave North, to the deep east. Telegraph to the Ave North, to the deep east. To the youth in the beast, HB, Third Street. Telegraph to the Ave North.
We're back here in the studio at Relatos Zapatistas, broadcasting live from West Oakland on 104.1 FM, streaming live at berkeleyliberationradio.net. We're winding down the show a little bit now. We've been talking about May Day, May 1st, and what happened here in Oakland and across the country, around the world a little bit here. And you can still, you know, we have probably 10 more minutes here. If you have a question or comment, you want to call into the studio, give us a call. The number is 510-495-1666. Once again, the number is 510-495-1666. And if you don't make it calling into the studio today, you can always shoot us an email at relatoszapatistas. Both those words are plural. RelatosZapatistas@gmail.com, and we'll try to get back to you for the next show. The first Sunday of the month will be in June. I'm not sure of what day that's going to be, but this show will be up on the internet after the fact at indiebay.org and also on the website of our compañeros down in Chiapas. Their website is radiozapatista.org. And so we're just going to finish up today, just kind of maybe going around and asking you guys who are left here in the studio, you know, what does May Day mean for Occupy Oakland? And, you know, if you have any thoughts about that.
So as I was listening to Tony talk about gang injunctions and Stephen talk about gentrification and the way that it's playing out and thinking about Occupy and the Oscar Grant uprisings and all of these sorts of things, one of the things that I think has happened for a lot of people is that they saw the Oscar Grant uprisings, they maybe got involved in the gang injunctions or heard about it. They may have sort of been peripherally aware of what's been going on in downtown Oakland and across Oakland in terms of gentrification. But a lot of people, I think, were brought in by how they saw Occupy taking on their own personal issues. And as they came in, like as these guys were talking about, and so like as this relates to the question of May Day, we see that people are able to pick up on how their struggle and the things that they're going through personally relate to these other things like gentrification, gang injunctions, police brutality, institutional institutionalized racism. And so I think that, and of course, I can't believe I forgot this, but of course, like the immigrants' rights struggle and how that plays into May Day, you know, people may have been going to these marches, like a Day Without Immigrants in 2006 in San Francisco, which was incredible, but maybe hadn't thought about it again until Occupy marched, you know, in the same time and space as the Dignity and Resistance March. And so seeing all of these things come together, hopefully May Day was sort of this awakening for people to realize, like, oh, your struggle is my struggle and my struggle is your struggle and we're in this together. So I'm hoping that there have been a lot of bridges built. And I know for me, like, despite being aware of these things, certainly, like, I feel like it's more organic now. It's more tied together. And so moving forward, hopefully we can all kind of work together and realize that these struggles are the same struggles against, you know, patriarchy and capitalism, racism, institutionalized racism, gentrification, and so on.
Well, I think that one thing that was really inspiring about sort of the build up to May Day and the sort of organizing that I saw was the development of lots of autonomous groups that were doing things sort of in the space, the general space of Occupy Oakland, but also sort of breaking off from that space and forming different groups. So one of them was the Precarious Workers Assembly, which is a group that meets bi-weekly in San Francisco and then also in Oakland at 19th and Telegraph. And that's a group that emerged sort of with the idea of really being a force for May Day, but also is going to continue on and will also be organizing and sort of figuring things out after May Day. And so I've seen a lot of that, those sort of different connections come out of May Day and the general push for May Day. And I think that those connections and those affinities are really important in terms of going into the summer and seeing sort of the terrain of struggle in the summer and looking at, you know, five schools are slated for closure. You know, foreclosures are still on the rise. Unemployment is still growing. You know, there's a campaign right now to work on AC Transit. So I think that a lot of the connections that have grown out of sort of the general build for May Day will be a big force into the summer.
Yeah, I just want to say that I think May Day also raised some really important questions of tactics and strategy amongst the so-called left. And I think that a lot of folks were really geared up and trying to organize around May Day. And I think it actually fostered critical communication that we often don't have amongst ourselves around questions of permits, around questions of unity and solidarity, and bringing all of the struggles that capital creates in our communities. It actually brought a lot of those together, as was mentioned. That's really key. But it also brings together a lot of different organizers with different backgrounds. And I really hope that what can happen out of May Day is that communication can continue, and actually that those critical conversations and potentially confrontations around politics continue. Because something that I think is really important, at least for me, that Occupy Oakland has done is created spaces for critical political struggle and conversation that weren't really existent. And a lot of communities and political affiliations, maybe, or organizations hadn't really been talking to each other. And what's really great about Occupy Oakland is that it does create that space, and sometimes it's difficult to struggle around these issues of tactics and strategy. But I think it's wonderful that it's actually happening, and folks who haven't really been talking to each other or even recognizing that they even existed are having those conversations. And I really hope that folks go beyond the kind of our own borders within our own movements to kind of overcome those borders and really build solid communities that are struggling and can attain victories against the system.
All right. Well, thanks so much, you guys. You've been listening to Relatos Zapatistas on Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM. We've been talking here with Tony, Stephen, Lauren, and earlier we were talking with Omar as well about May Day, May 1st, and Occupy Oakland, and the general strike in an age of precarity. You can tune back into the show next month, Relatos Zapatistas, on the first Sunday of the month, which I just checked the calendar. It's going to be June 3rd from 4 to 6 p.m. In the meantime, shoot us an email at relatoszapatistas@gmail.com. If you have any comments or questions or any suggestions for anything you want us to cover on the next show. And in the meantime, you know, we'll see you on the streets.
Peace.